Chapter 9, Core Values. World War II had stirred America's sometimes tepid melting pot in countless ways. Women and men toiled together on factory floors and in wartime enterprises. Enlistees traveled far from home for training and deployment. Soldiers and sailors of every creed and color fought and died in Europe and Asia, and millions of Americans encountered people from unfamiliar cultures while serving abroad. On Colgate's campus, the Navy training programs had also brought greater religious and ethnic diversity, perhaps even adding a modicum of racial diversity as well, since naval units were slowly being integrated by 1944. The Navy's heightened sensitivities to religious differences were evident to Everett Case when he invited the president of Colgate Rochester Divinity School, Reverend Edwin Poteet, to speak at a chapel service in May 1945, commemorating the 125th anniversary of the arrival of Daniel Haskell's first students. He cautioned Poteet to give a non-sectarian talk instead of a sermon to the 100 civilian students and the 500 trainees in the Navy's V-12 and V-7 programs, restyling the occasion as an assembly rather than a chapel service. Under naval directives, Case explained, we are prohibited from requiring attendance of the trainees, composed as they are, of Protestants, Catholics, and Jews at any religious services. One influential trustee had already weighed in publicly on the subject of Colgate's lack of diversity. Orrin G. Judd, class of 1926, was New York State's Solicitor General. He had spoken passionately about the subject of race relations at an alumni gathering in 1944. When asked to comment on the emerging core curriculum, Judd contended that one topic had been left out: interracial relations. Because it is a problem which must be lived out rather than just studied, he wrote Case, I think that a white Gentile college is becoming a pernicious anachronism. It is not only out of step with the times, but it accustoms young men to living only with people of their kind instead of with a cross-section of the American population. He explained he had learned a lot from classmates Buddy Levinson and Henry Robinson, who were Jewish and black, respectively, and fellow students Ramsey Harris of Burma and Kazutaka Watanabe of Japan. I think it is important that the college make a definite effort to have as broad a selection of students from all racial groups as possible, he wrote. Formal and informal strictures on admissions and faculty hiring slowly began to erode after the war. Still, in September 1947, except for the fact that nearly 30% had already served in the military, the 350 freshmen in the class of 1951 resembled a pre-war class in many respects. A median age of 18.5 years, two-thirds arriving from public high schools, with nearly half having graduated in the top quarter of their class. No black students were among them. While slightly more than half were from New York State, some 22 states, the District of Columbia, the Hawaiian Territory, and one foreign country were also represented. And the class's announced professional ambitions would have surprised the institution's founders. Only three of the 350 men in the class thought they might become ministers, while 88 had their sights set on careers in business, 47 on medicine and dentistry, and 34 on law. Nearly a third of entering freshmen expressed no specific career preference as they began their studies, typical of students attracted to a liberal arts college. Indeed, the most apparent sign of increasing diversity in the late 1940s was not about race, but about religion. At Colgate, as at most private colleges, students were asked to include their religious affiliation on their college applications. While critics could readily see how this might be used as a tool of exclusion, Colgate administrators defended it, claiming the question merely helped the college allocate adequate resources to the chaplain's office. A new university chaplain and professor of religion, Kenneth Morgan, had been hired in 1946, marking yet another departure from the university's Baptist heritage. A Quaker and conscientious objector during World War II, his academic interests lay in comparative religion. The construction of Chapel House, which opened in 1959 as a place of prayer and meditation, would be his lasting legacy. Morgan served a student body that was still predominantly Protestant, but markedly different from the Baptist College of previous decades. The vast majority of Colgate freshmen in 1947, over three-quarters of the class, claimed membership in one or another of the mainline Protestant denominations, with one-third listing themselves as Episcopalian or Presbyterian. Baptists were dwindling in numbers, making up less than 10% of the class. Catholics and Jews numbered slightly more than 14% and 3% of the class, respectively, a decided change from the 1930s. Only six students listed no religion at all. More than 2.2 million students ultimately attended college on the GI Bill, and the influx of students provoked a nationwide look at college admissions procedures, especially at elite institutions where applicants far exceeded available slots. In 1946, the American Mercury magazine asked officials at 700 colleges and universities about the persistence of quotas and other discriminatory practices, with their eye on comparing current numbers with the pre-war enrollment percentages of Jewish, Black, and Catholic students. Almost all of the 520 colleges that responded to the survey contended that they did not discriminate on the basis of religion, although 94 colleges, mostly in the South, did acknowledge publicly that they did not admit Blacks. The author of the article argued that despite the respondents' answers, colleges were concealing a pervasive hypocrisy about discrimination. Indeed, many colleges admitted privately that they used various screening mechanisms, less overt than setting explicit quotas, to reject students on religious or racial grounds. Colgate was among the Eastern colleges, as were Dartmouth and Princeton, singled out for having been among the least welcoming of Jews before the war. Pressures to change admissions practices mounted. A more rigorous post-war study of discrimination in New York State's colleges and universities was undertaken at the behest of Governor Thomas E. Dewey's Temporary Commission on the Need for a State University, which had begun to lay out plans for a comprehensive state educational system. The commission was chaired by President Case's father-in-law, Owen D. Young, the former chairman of General Electric. Case followed the commission's work closely. In short order, the commission put together data that confirmed the prevailing perception that the state's private colleges were not meeting the educational needs of all New Yorkers, and that many were blatantly discriminatory. Colgate, in accepting only 7% of its Jewish applicants while granting admission to 32% of its overall applicant pool, was found to be among the state's miscreants. In the university's defense, Case said that no static picture could capture the sweeping difference in the composition of the student body since the early 1900s, when the school was still predominantly Baptist. Today, the Catholics far outnumber the Baptists, and the Jews are not very far behind, he wrote in a lengthy letter to his father-in-law. We even have a dozen or so who are members of the Greek Orthodox Church. Assimilation at the colleges has progressed at a more rapid rate than in any social structure of the nation generally. But the pace of change was still slow. In 1948, New York State passed a Fair Education Practices Act, creating a quasi-judicial office to hear and resolve student complaints about discriminatory admissions practices. Race remained a much more onerous obstacle to admission, the bitter legacy of the cut in ears. A prominent student of that sad era, Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., having been elected to Congress in 1944, was powerfully positioned to advocate for change at his alma mater. He sent a terse query, one blunt sentence, to President Case in 1947. I'm writing to find out if the policy of the exclusion of Negro men still obtains at Colgate, and if not, what steps should be taken for the right type to apply for admission. He did not elaborate on what he meant by right type although the year before he had been asked by the Dean of Admissions for his informal assessment of several black applicants, none of whom, in the end, was admitted. Case's response to Powell struck a less than amicable tone, calling Powell's question rather puzzling, if not actually disingenuous. There had been black trainees among the various Navy units on campus, Case asserted, although he conceded that there had been no black civilian students since the end of the war. Case argued that the absence of black students was not strange, considering our remoteness from the more cosmopolitan centers of population and the limited opportunity for intercourse with other educated Negroes afforded by the community of which Colgate is a part. He went on to say that the college would welcome black students if they were admitted in open competition with the field, informing Powell that one or two in the current applicant pool of 2,000 warranted the admissions committee's serious consideration. That said, he registered a lingering worry that each black student would have to decide whether he would be happier here or elsewhere, given the small numbers likely to enroll. While he did not promise more vigorous recruiting efforts on the part of the university, he did say that alumni recommendations, irrespective of the applicant's race, creed, or color, would be helpful. As demands for civil rights and equal opportunity intensified in the 1950s and 1960s, such a tepid response would not prove to be an adequate answer. The Colgate Corps. In the decades after World War II, if one feature defined Colgate's academic life, it was the interdisciplinary core curriculum, introduced in September 1946 to the entering freshman class. It evolved gradually, with new courses added each year as the class of 1950 progressed toward graduation. Ultimately, the core accounted for between one quarter and one third of a student's coursework. Revised and refined at frequent intervals, its most essential features survived for some three decades. Rather than putting general education entirely in the first 2 years, as most other colleges tended to do, the aim at Colgate was a comprehensive, vertical integration of the curriculum from freshman to senior year. Colgate also eschewed distribution requirements, the fragmented approach to general education preferred at many other colleges as a way of introducing students to diverse academic departments. The core offered a solution to what Dean of Faculty Sidney French had termed the over-departmentalization of American higher education. What is needed, he argued, is not weaker departments, but stronger unity in the whole of higher education. A division of university studies was established to oversee the emerging core, and at the same time, the six schools of the old Colgate plan were replaced by the divisions of humanities, social sciences, and natural sciences. The goal was to integrate the curriculum across both departmental and divisional lines. Abandoning the previous survey courses, most of the initial core courses were designed around a problems approach, which some faculty members assumed was a method akin to the Harvard Business School's use of case studies. But President Case, though a longtime advocate of case studies, contended that the Colgate curriculum was not patterned on the methods of the business school, but was instead employing case studies to break down disciplinary boundaries in undergraduate teaching. Case studies were designed to expose students to those concrete and often ungainly problems, the transcripts of actual experience, which confront men everywhere, not as economists or psychologists or philosophers, but as citizens and responsible human beings. The problems approach provided a common pedagogic method, whether students were taking core courses in the social or natural sciences. For example, in the physical and biological sciences, freshmen were expected to analyze problems as if they were scientists confronting a question for the first time, which Dean French thought would allow students to develop an understanding of the way scientists solve or attempt to solve their problems. In the core's early years, freshmen also devoted two semesters to intelligent inquiry of problems in public affairs, gleaned from industry, government, village offices, country courthouses, and the man on the street. No longer reliant on textbooks, faculty members were constantly challenged to come up with new material, drawing on court decisions, pieces of legislation, or policy pronouncements. Most students in the 1950s and 1960s would agree that the year-long core course with the most profound and enduring impact was the freshman's encounter with philosophy and religion, known to all as P&R. It was a study of philosophical and religious problems as these were defined in their historical context. The course relied on certain prismatic primary selections that highlight the intellectual and spiritual heritage of Western man, and that likewise tend to define contemporary philosophical and religious issues. It became a bedrock of the freshman year experience, demanding close reading and alert classroom discussion, taught by some of the most dynamic and challenging professors in Colgate's Department of Philosophy and Religion. With all freshmen taking the course in lockstep, reading the same course assignments at the same time, and studying for the same midterms and finals, the academic experience was communal, including a ritual P&R riot on the eve of the first midterm, echoes of the cremation of Livy. 50 years on, Preet Wesseland, class of 64, remembered it as a course that shook our moral certitude, forcing us to examine the nature of our faith and the strength of our character. His classmate, Ed Cummings, agreed, saying that P&R asked questions that I had never heard, couldn't answer then, can't answer now, but I never stopped trying. Advancing to sophomore year, students initially confronted two core courses, one in music and the visual arts, another in literature. They were folded together into a single course on music, poetry, drama, and the visual arts in the mid-1950s. When asked why art occupied such a prominent place in the core, the teaching staff answered that by achieving an understanding of art, we have increased by one the number of symbolic methods by which we may reach an understanding of the universe that we inhabit. They believe the arts played as central a role in the search for knowledge as scientific or philosophical inquiry. There was novelty in the course's effort to find unity among the diverse creative fields, and perhaps even greater novelty in requiring such a course in a men's college. In 1960, the faculty members in this core won financial support from the Danforth Foundation to prepare a new book of readings in the arts. The most noteworthy substantive change from the old Colgate plan was the core's global emphasis. The Committee on the Postwar College had lamented that Americans were provincial and lacking knowledge and understanding of other peoples. The Colgate faculty, so many of them having served abroad during the war, sought to broaden student perspectives. The university pioneered by including an area studies requirement at the undergraduate level, at first putting the courses in the sophomore year. Area studies programs proliferated at the end of World War II at the graduate level, building on the 50-odd Army specialized training programs that had trained more than 100,000 soldiers in the languages, cultures, economies, and politics of the regions to which they would be deployed. Realizing that America's global burdens would grow much heavier after the war, the major philanthropic foundations, Carnegie and Rockefeller, soon joined by Ford, poured millions of dollars into graduate programs in Russian studies, Asian studies, Latin American studies, and programs devoted to studying many other regions of the world. Colgate soon won resources for its approach to area studies. The core courses devoted to foreign areas initially focused on seven regions: Russia, the course taught by Russian professor Albert Perry and history professor Douglas Redding, were the most popular in the early 1950s. Latin America. In 1949, a semester-long study group began traveling to Argentina, and a Latin American studies concentration was introduced. India and South Asia, the Far East, Western Europe, with a primary focus on France, and Central Europe, initially looking at post-war Germany. In exposing students to the cultures and problems of these areas, the courses reflected the interdisciplinary spirit of area studies. They aimed to give students an understanding of how such factors as physical environment, social structure and institutions, economic organization and activities, political organization, population composition and distribution, traditional mores and culture are interdependent, interact, and contribute to the problems of the given area. When a Carnegie Corporation staff member visited the campus in 1953, he saw Colgate's approach to area studies as an interesting experiment at the undergraduate level, reporting to his foundation colleagues that the courses were required of every student and taught genuinely as area studies, not merely through the lens of a single discipline. He found the coverage of the diverse regions to be more extensive than anything available in other undergraduate programs, although he cautioned that it was challenging for a small college's faculty to cover every region with someone explicitly trained in the area studies approach. When two Carnegie staff members returned in 1955, they advocated making a 5-year grant to support area studies, seeing the overall core as a logical extension to the pioneering general education work at Colgate. They admired the area studies requirement and hoped that this idea may spread to many other institutions which have largely neglected non-Western civilizations. Having backed the pre-war Colgate plan, Carnegie decided to support Colgate's new core curriculum and in the end made a 6-year, $120,000 commitment. Although they were creating a more extensive, globally oriented curriculum, the faculty turned away from language requirements. They expected entering students to have studied at least one foreign language in high school, but they dropped any additional course requirements at the college level. Proficiency in a language would still be required of all graduating students, defined minimally as 3 years of study, but competence could be demonstrated by passing a test rather than undertaking formal coursework. Basic language instruction, the post-war committee believed, should be the responsibility of secondary schools. The focus at the college level would be on more advanced work in a language and encouraged primarily for those interested in particular areas of the world. The university began to look into some of the wartime teaching methods used by the Army, and in doing so, opened a new language laboratory in Lawrence Hall. While majors in Russian and Russian studies were available on campus, by the early 1960s, a handful of students in exotic languages were spending a year at Princeton in the Carnegie-funded Critical Languages program. Several other innovations accompanied the introduction of the core. Freshman composition, a staple of English departments in most colleges, was dropped as a requirement, at least initially. Nevertheless, the faculty took seriously the widespread complaint that graduates of high schools and colleges write their native languages badly. They lamented that colleges across the country had suffered defeat in the Custer's last stand known as freshman composition. Instead, the focus at Colgate, as at other colleges, turned to functional writing, in which assignments would emanate from the subject matter in the core and other courses. Students might be assigned the task of writing a journalistic account about a scientific breakthrough or challenged to analyze or rebut a political opinion piece. Professors in the relevant courses were expected to read and grade the assignments, with preceptors also offering guidance on writing. A course in communications was added to the core, but turning students into better writers and speakers continued to pose challenges. While the approach to functional writing seemed to be effective, the attempt to incorporate larger issues by exposing students to communications theory, linguistics research, and media analysis was criticized for producing hasty, trivial, and slipshod work. Students were also dismissive, describing the course as unchallenging and unrewarding, while leveling some of their severest criticism at the young preceptors who were hired to help with writing, but who were themselves only a year or two out of college. Courses in communications were dropped in 1960. The program for seniors was still inchoate when the core was introduced, but with aspirational titles such as the liberal tradition and the dynamic of freedom, the faculty wanted them to cap their studies with an overview of Western democratic values. With the battle against fascism recently won and the ideological contours of the Cold War more clearly visible, Dean French was clear about why such a course mattered, and his language was echoed in the Colgate catalogs of the era. The worth and dignity of the individual, the basic values of our Western culture, the development of educational, social, economic, scientific, and political conditions that make for the realization of human dignity and freedom everywhere cannot be neglected in our times. Marvin Walkman, one of the newest members of the History Department, was asked in 1949 to plan the new senior year corps that would, in the end, be called the American Idea in the Modern World. As the catalog described it, the course sought, through an examination of our fundamental cultural documents and practices, to determine the validity and effectiveness of the American way in the current conflict of ideologies at home and abroad. Courses with similar titles at other colleges and universities tended to treat the subject matter as a course in comparative political systems and the values that undergirded them. At Colgate, the course did indeed explore different ideologies, but it also had a sociological bent, assigning readings that included David Reisman's The Lonely Crowd, C. Wright Mills' White Collar, and William H. White's The Organization Man. Later, the course was expanded into a two-semester junior year core devoted to American ideals and institutions. After studying the fundamental historical documents in the first semester, the course looked at the forces, movements, and changes in our social order which strained the maintenance of this system of beliefs. In the 1960s, course readings included writings by W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, as well as the autobiography of Malcolm X and other contemporary works. Finally, for the senior year, a new capstone core emerged, America in the World Community. It was a complement to area studies courses, a broad exploration of global issues. Walkman described the faculty's collaborative efforts in developing the upper-level core courses. Among ourselves, we debated the roots of our values, their legitimacy, and whether and how we as a nation lived up to them. The gap between our pronouncements in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and our practices, especially in matters of race, occupied a good deal of our time. We struggled to find a balance between applause and criticism for American institutions. Walkman and some of his faculty colleagues also struggled with the question of whether Colgate as an institution had lived up to the pronouncements of the nation's founding documents. Walkman, who would depart in 1961 to become president of the historically black Lincoln University, had been joined by only one other Jewish faculty member in the 5 years after the war. The student body, while growing more religiously diverse, enrolled only a few African Americans in each class. That demographic shock was apparent to Mel Watkins' class of 62 when he arrived for his freshman year in 1958. Watkins had grown up in a black neighborhood in Youngstown, Ohio, and was an all-state basketball player and alumni war memorial scholar. Traveling to Hamilton, getting lost on the back roads of Madison County, and seeing no other black faces as they arrived in the village and grabbed a farewell meal at the Bluebird restaurant, his family was wary of this strange outpost. Although I suspected that we would be in the minority, Watkins remembered, I didn't think we would be an endangered species. Among Colgate's 1,300 students, there were only 16 black Americans, five in his class, and a few African exchange students. Watkins knew that he had landed in a university struggling to diversify, but he saw a place that still betrayed ample evidence of the attitudes that Adam Clayton Powell Jr. had confronted 3 decades earlier. Among other obstacles, Watkins counted only 3 fraternities open to blacks, while he would develop lasting friendships with both black and white classmates. His social life often took him to Syracuse, where he found a more welcoming and familiar community. Fraternities and race. Fraternities remained at the center of Colgate student life. After freshman year, nearly 90% of the student body joined one of Colgate's 13 fraternities. But fraternities were coming under pressure, external as well as internal, to open their doors to a more diverse student body. In the early 1950s, 4 fraternities still operated under national charters explicitly barring membership on both racial and religious grounds. 4 other fraternities restricted membership on racial grounds but had no religious bars to membership. Only 5 Colgate fraternities had national charters completely free of racial and religious restrictions. In 1953, the issue of discrimination in fraternities and sororities came to a head in New York State when the SUNY system banned organizations with restrictive national charters from all 33 of its campuses. Colgate students took notice, and the campus experienced what President Case called an increasing groundswell of student resentments at national restrictions on their freedom to pledge fellow students of their own choice. While students in the 1950s had been stereotyped as apathetic and disengaged from politics, at least some fraternity members at Colgate were willing to speak out against systemic prejudice. Colgate's Interfraternity Council recorded its opposition to discriminatory clauses and urged individual chapters to voice their objections when the national organizations convened. Phi Kappa Tau, which housed an African-American student for 3 semesters but was forbidden to let him formally pledge the fraternity, took one of the boldest public stands. When he attended the National Convention in 1953, Ronald Shongar, class of 54, interrogated the fraternity's leaders and challenged the brothers from other chapters to confront the issue of discrimination. Despite Shongar's best efforts that summer, the national fraternity did not budge. Evading its national charter restrictions, another fraternity, Sigma Chi, discreetly pledged a student from Hong Kong, Robert Ho, class of 56. 50 years on, Ho was still grateful as he celebrated the enduring fraternal bonds at a gathering in Chicago. Though their numbers were small, some individuals resigned from their fraternities to protest the restrictions, including, in 1954, the editor of the Maroon, the president of the Glee Club, and a basketball star. In the spring of 1954, the Student Senate, urged on by its president, Ivar Berg, class of 54, passed a resolution calling for every fraternity to submit a biennial progress report demonstrating it had taken constructive action toward eliminating discriminatory clauses from its national charter. The Senate set a 1964 deadline for either the complete removal of the offending clauses from the national charters or for fraternities to win local autonomy in selecting their members. Responding to the Student Senate resolution and the recurrent student deputations that had appealed to him for the university to take action to end discrimination, President Case addressed the student body at a chapel session on April 5th. He spoke first about the university's admissions policies, insisting there were no longer discriminatory restrictions on any individual or group. He termed it a matter of right and justice. Anticipating the Cold War rationale that would loom large only a month later in Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, the Supreme Court decision that outlawed segregated schools, he went on to say that in addition to believing discriminatory attitudes and policies are injurious to our national reputation and open the door to adverse communist exploitation, I believe they're bad educationally as well. While insisting he deplored the existence of restrictive clauses in fraternity charters, he denied that it was the administration's role, despite considerable pressure to do so, to banish discriminatory practices by simple fiat. "Primarily, this is your problem," he told the students, "and I don't think it is sound educational policy to take it out of your hands. If students prove to be successful in ending discrimination," he told them, "their efforts would be of service to both country and college, and at the same time would teach them about the functioning of democracy in dealing with America's unfinished business." The Student Senate promptly took the matter into its own hands, scheduling a referendum for May 3rd that would seek the student body's endorsement of Senate procedures pressuring fraternities to end discrimination. The Senate was applauded by the editors of the Maroon, who praised a plan emerging entirely from student initiative and effort. But when the referendum votes were tallied, there was immediate dismay. While 599 students had voted in favor of the measures and 361 against, the referendum required a majority of the entire student body. With only 3/4 of the student body voting, the resolution had fallen short by 33 votes. The Maroon urged that the fight continue, and more than 500 students petitioned for a new referendum, arguing that mere technicalities had led to the defeat of the proposal. The Student Senate regrouped, clarifying what it meant for a fraternity to take constructive action, and explaining how the procedures for judging and sanctioning fraternities would function. A second referendum was held at the end of May, once again requiring a majority of all students. With greater publicity and higher turnout, the initiative was approved, with 70% of the student body voting in favor. Seeing the autonomy of individual fraternities threatened, a trustee committee decided to weigh in. The trustees were skeptical of the student referendum, contending that forcing the issue on the fraternities with a definite time limit and with implementation by constantly changing generations of undergraduates would be grossly unfair to the fraternities with offending clauses. They looked at the ways 14 other colleges were dealing with discriminatory national charters and concluded that the Interfraternity Council and the Alumni Interfraternity Council should work through the normal, established procedures of each national organization. While the trustees declared restrictive clauses to be relics of the past and would not permit any new fraternities with restrictive clauses to be established on campus, they were unwilling to hasten the process of ridding the campus of discriminatory fraternities. They requested a first progress report from the alumni fraternity group in 3 years and sought another report 3 years after that. Neither the administration nor the board viewed ending fraternity discrimination as an especially urgent moral issue. Their concerns were primarily financial. Rapidly rising college costs, lagging endowment growth, low faculty salaries, inadequate research funding, and cramped campus facilities for a student body 50% larger than before the war. These were all seen as more important. Educating the whole man. If the discussions that shaped the core curriculum were about how Colgate students were to be educated in the classroom, there were still unresolved questions about how they were living their lives outside the classroom. A faculty committee on the residential college went to work in January 1954 to understand why student social behavior and academic performance seemed to have worsened. Their conversations with professors and administrators at several other men's colleges, Dartmouth, Amherst, and Williams in particular, alleviated some of their worries. Colgate's problems were common to other all-male schools. The committee blamed diverse factors, awkwardly lumping together their concerns about the increased reliance upon girls for the social life of students in men's colleges, the greater increase in the number of cars, which make it easy for many more students to leave the campus, the broader social acceptance of drinking, and the expectation that at least 2 more years would be spent in military service. A survey of seniors in the class of 1956 offered statistical confirmation of at least some aspects of the report. No one would have been surprised to learn that students were fleeing the campus. 73% of the class said that they had traveled to Skidmore to meet girls, and if other women's colleges had been included, the numbers surely would have approached 100%. 66% boasted that they averaged more than 4 dates per month. And many were not wedded to their studies. Fewer than half said that they studied more than 10 hours a week, and 14% had faced academic probation at some point in their college careers. Seeking solutions that would keep students on campus, and preferably on the Hill, the Residential College Committee proposed improving and reconceiving campus housing by renovating East, West, Andrews, and Stillman halls and constructing new dorms so that all freshmen and sophomores would have rooms, social spaces, and dining halls near the quad. New residences for upperclassmen, Dodge, Kendrick, and Eaton, opened in 1958 on the site of Eaton Hall, the old seminary building, giving students a residential alternative to pledging a fraternity. Fraternities face their own housing problems, with houses on Broad Street overcrowded, run down, and in some cases suffering serious financial woes. Fraternities were also judged to be a source of campus division, inculcating divided loyalties among students and, at times, as one report deftly put it, operating in opposition to the college. Students were blunter in their assessments, complaining that fraternities encouraged anti-intellectual attitudes that undermined the educational objectives of the college and fostered a spirit of non-involvement. One perennial sore spot, according to a faculty self-study committee, was control over athletics, with the alumni-dominated athletic council operating outside the governance structures of both board and faculty, giving the director of athletics and his alumni supporters a direct line to the board of trustees. With 570 athletes playing on 14 varsity and 12 freshman teams, expenses were hard to control, especially the costs of remaining competitive in football. Defeats at the hands of Syracuse, the last win had come in 1950, were embarrassing, including a 61-7 loss in 1956 to a team led by Orange running back Jim Brown, and a 71-0 loss in 1959 to a number one ranked Syracuse team. There were occasional bursts of glory, such as defeating Harvard, Princeton, and Yale on successive weekends in 1961, but the competitive terrain in college athletics had begun to shift. Restraining costs, reassessing the level of competition, and rethinking recruitment led the committee to recommend that the Athletic Council be reconstituted as a faculty trustee committee responsible through proper administrative channels to the board. A trustee-faculty tradition of shared governance is one of the distinctive features of American higher education. It demands broad consultation, patience and deliberation, respect for diverse professional competencies, and in the end, compromises that rarely please everyone. Looking ahead to some of the difficult decisions facing the university, the self-study committee gently warned that there had been instances of confusion and uncertainty between board and faculty. The committee had cautionary words about the bewildering proliferation of planning groups and the university's already complicated policymaking mechanisms. It urged that great care be exercised in the future to avoid vesting any such committees, even with a semblance of policymaking authority. Those complaints were likely aimed at still another planning body, a group that enjoyed the title All University Council. It had been established by the board in 1959 and given the sweeping charge to take a look at Colgate's past and present with a view to doing some further planning for its future. The brainchild of Trustee Clarence J. Myers, class of 1920, the president and chairman of New York Life Insurance Company, the 15-member council included representatives drawn three each from the trustees, alumni, faculty, administration, and students. It spent more than a year gathering data and seeking testimony from various university constituencies. A detailed portrait of the university's passage through the decade of the 1950s and its needs for the 1960s emerged, and along the way it exposed some of the tensions that would divide the campus in the 1960s. Worries and complaints came from every constituency. At the council's first meeting, President Case expressed his alarm at increasing college costs, saying that the council members would have been frightened to death if they had known in 1939 that college costs would triple by 1959. Faculty continued to be troubled by the campus culture, decrying weekenditis and what had become a 4.5-day work week, complaining that the weekend exodus has attained gross proportions, scholastic performance has failed to benefit, and participation in all manner of voluntary activities has relatively declined. They noted that the library was nearly empty on weekends, and attendance at athletic events had plummeted. Even sports teams suffered, with some high school stars reportedly reluctant to try out for teams. The council worried about remaining competitive in more than a dozen sports when the school had only 1,300 students and retained its long-standing aspirations to take on the Ivy League and larger universities. At issue was nothing less than the aim of a Colgate education and what kinds of students would benefit from it. The council subcommittee charged with examining academic programs reiterated the words of the college catalog. The college believes that its province is the whole man and that the student's overall development is its true objective and concern. A Colgate education was structured, the catalog explained, to help students develop a sense of vocation, to prepare them for professional schools and to produce graduates who could play a constructive part in maintaining and developing the free society, which is our heritage. Active participation in both the academic and extracurricular life of the college was the key. Thus, both intellectual and physical prowess were to be valued. The emphasis was on attracting the well-rounded student, a young man competent enough as a scholar, eager to assume a leadership role in a fraternity or student organization, and perhaps a varsity athlete. 40% of the student body competed at that level, with most others almost certainly engaged in intramurals. The chairman of the Academic Affairs Subcommittee, Harold Voorhis, class of 1919, a college administrator at New York University, chose his words carefully, with tortured syntax, in describing this budding controversy over what kind of students Colgate should admit. There seems to be considerable contention by persons not easily misled that there are campus tendencies at Colgate incompatible with the traditional objectives. This criticism alleges a determined faction of the faculty not wedded to the Colgate pattern that would modify it through greater emphasis on pure scholarship, that such a faction seems to be more interested in sheer intellectuality than the broader attributes of effective humanity, and that while these faculty members may be altogether well-meaning and academically dedicated persons, they lack a sense of loyalty to Colgate's scholarship-plus tradition, perhaps because they themselves do not happen to be products thereof. Scholarship-plus and the whole man were deaf terms that suggested admission to Colgate would not be based primarily on academic accomplishments, but instead on a mix of abilities with, in the view of critics, too much weight given to athletic ability. Perhaps showing his own hand, Voorhis pointed ruefully to an article in Life magazine noting that, however flippant and superficial the article, it suggests that Colgate is in no imminent danger of becoming a seminary of scholarly genius. Philosophy professor Herman Brautigam offered his take on what it meant to educate the whole man, finding it unobjectionable, even admirable, if we mean by it a man in whom intellectual power, moral responsibility, and artistic sensibility are developed on a foundation of physical fitness. But for many, the whole man means the well-rounded man who can do a little of everything but is not necessarily expert at anything. He asked whether the college was willing to settle for a modest athletic prestige in which academic distinction will necessarily be subordinated. The question of balance, weighing scholarly attainments against a cluster of traits contributing to well-roundedness, remained unresolved for both board and faculty. But Brautigam and some of his colleagues had begun to think more seriously about the role of the arts and the future of the humanities at Colgate. As in most all-male colleges, the arts had had only a tenuous role in Colgate's educational objectives. Although musical performances had been popular since the 1830s and plays had been performed since the turn of the century, they were largely extracurricular activities. The music and art departments were small. Funding and facilities remained woeful. When the Colgate Plan survey courses were introduced in the 1930s and the core took shape in the 1950s, music and the visual arts secured a place in the students' general education. But these general education courses were a cultural adornment, the refining piece of a gentleman's education, fostering a passive appreciation rather than deeper engagement with the arts. Not until the mid and late 1950s did this neglect of the arts arouse much concern. With funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, a faculty committee spent 3 years studying the humanities and produced a 328-page report in 1958 that underscored the role the arts could play in a liberal arts college. While acknowledging the conventional aims of a liberal education, developing students' capacities to communicate effectively, teaching students to learn on their own, introducing them to developments in a variety of academic disciplines, the Faculty Committee's Humanities Report spoke of the profound and transformative effects of the arts. It expanded on the goals of a liberal education, saying, discriminating sensibility, sensitivity to human need, and the responsible use of freedom and power are educational goals as important as the goals of knowledge, the arts of communication, and critical thinking. In conceiving of human beings as self-conscious, imaginative, creative, free, and responsible, the report's authors place the cultivation of moral and aesthetic virtues on the same plane as intellectual virtues. Echoing the prevailing critique of American students in the 1950s as conformist, materialistic, and indifferent to intellectual and aesthetic values, the committee went about surveying alumni from the class of 51 and seniors in the class of 56. The faculty found particular fault with campus cultural life. If a student exhibits a serious interest in poetry or in music, in playing a violin, for instance, he does so often at the risk of being penalized, if not by ostracism, then by other forms of social pressure. While attendance at plays, concerts, and exhibitions was spotty, half the senior class offered a surprising response to the survey questions. They claimed that they were frustrated to be leaving college without having participated in a creative activity. Similarly, more than half the class of 1951 felt that they should have been required to engage in a carryover art, just as they had been required to learn a carryover sport. The authors of the Humanities Report built the case for the arts in part on this unmet student demand for more creative opportunities in the arts. Their report also reasserted the value of active participation in the arts as a valuable part of the liberal arts curriculum. To create is to think in new dimensions. It is to stand at one of the most exhilarating points in human experience, the point at which one discovers what art is by trying to be an artist. As for the humanities, the committee forcefully pointed toward the need for new facilities. What are students to think of the value of the humanities, the members lamented, when they find the Department of Philosophy and Religion, the Department of Music, and the Department of Fine Arts relegated to basements, along with lavatories, broom closets, storage bins, and refuse cans? The theater consisted of a few square feet in the Memorial Chapel basement, a space also coveted by the chaplain's office and musical groups. The music department had always had to curtail its individual voice and instrument instruction because of the very few music faculty members and their cramped teaching space in the basement. Their department also had to oversee extracurricular ensembles. A lone faculty member was responsible for directing the marching band, the glee club, and the community orchestra. The demands of the Corps also kept the music department from developing a curriculum strong enough in theory, composition, and upper-level course offerings to sustain a major in music. Studio art and art history were growing in popularity, with students eager to continue artistic interests sparked by the sophomore year core course. But the few studio courses that were offered were often oversubscribed, lacking both space and teaching faculty. The art department, acknowledging that its focus on Western art made for a provincial curriculum, hoped to add courses in Asian, then termed Oriental, and African, Latin American, and Oceanic art. Above all, the 1958 report was an appeal for a new building, which it described as a humanities center, underscoring the unity of the arts and humanities. It was envisioned as a physical base from which to work toward the ideal of altering student perspectives and integrating forces that are now disjointed and divisive. It would aim to stimulate at every turn a more creative way of life. However, its clearly stated purposes notwithstanding, no physical structure was yet visible on the campus planning horizon. But 4 years later, that would abruptly change. In 1962, the philanthropist Charles A. Dana paid a visit to campus. His foundation had supported the construction of new facilities on several other campuses, and President Case hoped that he would provide funding to transform the old 1890 library into a new language center. But as Dana toured the facilities, he saw firsthand that the arts were second class or worse. The music department, still confined mostly to the basement of the chapel, lacked virtually every necessity, even storage space for instruments. The chapel itself was unsuitable for many types of musical performances. Plays performed in the Little Theater in Lawrence Hall's basement made do with a stage 21 feet wide and 12 feet deep, no wing space, a menacing light board, and cramped seating for no more than 200. While it had been adequate as a showcase for debates and oratorical contests, which was its initial purpose, it had forced Mask and Triangle to scale down its productions and to perform in diverse off-campus venues, including the Hamilton Bank Building, the Congregational Church, the Opera House, the second floor of the old Academy Building, and even an abandoned barn. As for the curriculum, two drama courses were offered in the English department, but nothing in acting, directing, technical theater, or film. After his tour, Dana told Case that he thought what the campus most desperately needed was a building to house all the arts, to enable these essential activities of a first-rate college to move out of the basements of other buildings into a functionally oriented building constructed specifically for them. He pledged $400,000 toward its construction on condition that the university raise another $800,000. The university accepted the Dana Challenge Grant, and faculty quickly started presenting their wish lists. Professor Atlee Sproul, who arrived in 1960 and began to build a theater program, wanted a 500-seat theater up to Broadway technical standards. The three-member music department hoped for a 600-seat theater, four rehearsal rooms, two large classrooms, and two smaller classrooms for history and theory, 10 practice rooms, and more resources for individual instruction. The art faculty also had hopes for more significant studio space. The university made a daring and symbolic choice in commissioning Paul Rudolph to design the new building. His brutalist concrete structure would stand on a slight rise on the edge of Whitnall Field, more prominently situated than the Student Union. As the structure took shape, art professor Eric Ryan maintained that Rudolph had conceived a massive, rough building for a men's school. But the plans did not please the donor and ultimately fell far short of faculty hopes. When Dana viewed the model in New York, he objected to the site, the porte cochere, and a bridge that Rudolph had conceived to connect the building to the quad. The porte cochere remained, but the project proved more costly than had been anticipated and was scaled down. A second phase, which was to house a concert hall, art gallery, and rehearsal spaces, was never completed. When the Dana Arts Center opened in 1966, it did make a major statement about the university's commitment to the arts. But it was a forbidding place for music and musicians from the beginning. Concrete is not friendly to music. The spaces for rehearsal and teaching were cramped and lacked soundproofing. Instruction was hampered, whether it was individuals refining their technique on an instrument, musical ensembles practicing, or professors teaching their courses. The building was unsuitable for exhibition and storage of artworks. Theater fared only marginally better. The stage was far from the Broadway standard Sproul had wanted. Its floor quickly splintered and wing space was marginal. Dana's deficiencies have not been remedied. New facilities for both the visual and performing arts have been a perennial topic of campus conversation. Nevertheless, students in the 1960s were enthusiastic about the new structure. Anticipating its opening, Howard Snedkoff, class of 65, enlisted scores of students to help organize a two-day festival of the creative arts. Seeking to disprove the cries of our critics that we are a status-seeking, do-nothing, apathetic generation, Snedkoff said, the festival is conceived to show we are concerned. Over the course of 2 days in October 1964, nearly 900 students attended art exhibitions in the library with works borrowed from the Whitney Museum in New York, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and Utica's Munson Williams Proctor Art Institute. They watched films in a series curated by the Museum of Modern Art. They attended panels with composers and musicians. They heard from poets and novelists. They met artists and curators. Paul Rudolph attended and joined a panel discussion on modern architecture that included Norman Mailer, Susan Sontag, and Andrew Saris. The festival program, Poesis, was a collection of essays intended to spark ideas for the panel discussions. Adding excitement in the days before the festival were rumors that Marlon Brando might appear. A room at the University Motel was held for him. He did not show up. What precisely does it mean to be and to become? Winds of change were in the air by the early 1960s. Their force was, as yet, unforeseen. In 1962, four faculty members returned from a summer retreat where they gained fresh perspective on Colgate. They had spent 3 weeks in Colorado Springs with faculty from 27 other colleges, all invited to participate in a workshop on the liberal arts sponsored by the Danforth Foundation. Upon their return, Colgate's attendees prefaced their account of the meeting with a sense of mingled surprise and pride. First, we decided that Colgate is a much better college on the whole than we, the faculty, with our somewhat perverse capacity for self-criticism, are sometimes willing to admit. Colgate has its problems, but we know that in the past 2 decades, it has grown markedly in stature as an educational institution among American colleges. They went on to say that faculty at other colleges found the off-campus study and interdisciplinary cooperation among Colgate faculty exciting and worthy of emulation. The core, uneven as it sometimes felt to those teaching in it, was viewed favorably elsewhere and had gained us considerable respect. Hearing the accounts of work at other colleges, the Colgate participants also began to appreciate the overall unity and coherence of what they had accomplished within the core. They said that the core's special kind of vitality made it a prime asset. It was a sign of Colgate's tradition of experiment and change, with curricular reform a part of our institutional character. In speaking with faculty members from other colleges, they realized that the depth of the faculty's participation in the running of the institution was noted elsewhere, with envy. Their report concluded with a series of recommendations, acknowledging that the Colgate of the 1930s was gone forever, and conceding that the college of 1962 would not be the college of the 1970s or 1980s. They warned that for all its strengths, Colgate would have to act at an accelerated pace to avoid being stuck in an academic backwater. They offered recommendations on admission standards, expressing concern about the persistence of a certain uniform type of student, and they called for the admissions office to look for students in both urban and rural communities, signaling their ardent desire for a more diverse student body. They expressed concerns about the college's size, too large to be a small college and too small to do all that it aspired to do academically and athletically. They recommended an increase from 1,400 to 1,800 students. Questions about coeducation were vigorously debated in Colorado Springs, where a faculty member from one men's college bristled at the inevitability of it, saying they would go down fighting coeducation at his college, but without a doubt, his college would go down. A Colgate participant saw coeducation more favorably and suggested that an all-male college would clearly be an anachronism in 1982, especially if the daughters of alumni and their friends were not given the same educational opportunities as their sons. The other Colgate attendees agreed, seeing obvious advantages in coeducation and raising the prospects of creating a coordinate college for women, perhaps in collaboration with Hamilton College. Without rehearsing the arguments, for coeducation, which they saw as inevitable, the authors of the Colgate Report reminded their colleagues that many students had already attended all-male prep schools. 7 years of monastic life might be a trifle excessive, they concluded. At any rate, the best arguments for a women's coordinate college are those that stress the contribution that women would make to the academic and co-curricular life of the university. Their action plan for the 1960s included an expansion of off-campus study groups, reduced faculty teaching loads, fraternities opened to all students, an honor system, and a more aggressive public relations program to break out of the valley. Colgate was growing more confident in its reputation and its future. In February 1963, with Case having moved on to become president of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, the university welcomed a new president who seemed fully capable of pressing forward with the Danforth Committee ideas. Vincent Barnett, a specialist in international development who had chaired the political science department at Williams College and directed its Center for Development Economics, was appointed Colgate's 10th president. After receiving his PhD from Harvard in 1938 and joining the Williams faculty, he spent the war years in Washington with the Office of Price Administration and the War Production Board. In the decade after the war, government service took him to Italy in 1948 as assistant director of the aid mission to that country and back again as director of the Mutual Security Agency mission. In the late 1950s, he returned to Rome as counselor for economic affairs at the American Embassy. Barnett's appointment was greeted with enthusiasm by the faculty. Before arriving in Hamilton, he received a number of congratulatory letters, all looking ahead and all pleased that an accomplished academic from a well-regarded liberal arts college would be taking the helm. Dean Storing told Barnett that the college was ready for a real breakthrough and he should not worry about money. Ev Case brought it along on several fronts to first-class rank. His successor will have an easier, more rewarding job. Indeed, the college's financial status was steadily improving. Alumni participation in the annual fund was in the vicinity of 60%. A capital campaign that began in 1956 had set a target of $3.3 million for a new library, a field house, and increased faculty salaries. By 1958, nearly $6.2 million had been raised. The library and field house both opened that year, the former named for Case when he retired, and the latter named for the longtime director of athletics, William Reed, class of 1918. The financial status of the faculty was also improving. Salaries and benefit packages had climbed, with the average salary in excess of $9,000 in 1960. Modest research support was available, and a sabbatical program, which had been terminated during the Great Depression, was reintroduced in 1959. From his vantage point at Lincoln University, Marvin Wachman offered another appraisal of Colgate, feeling that the institution had been good for many years, a very substantial and solid institution, but that its curricular accomplishments were somewhat undersold in the academic community. As he saw it, Colgate had developed a new model for itself, a model consistent with the world in which we now live. While optimistic about Colgate, Barnett outlined some of the challenges that all liberal arts colleges were likely to face in the decade ahead. Their sense of purpose, he felt, was eroding as other types of institutions attracted students who might otherwise have sought a liberal education. He was particularly worried, though ultimately wrong, about a threat from the nation's expanding sector of junior colleges. But he was correct in perceiving that there would be pressures for increased specialization as greater numbers of undergraduates sought a wider range of educational opportunities at large institutions, recently labeled multiversities by Clark Kerr, president of the University of California. Facing such pressures, Barnett conceded in a meeting with his long-range planning committee, "We are a little worried about premature or excessive specialization." As always, there were financial worries. The college had grown dependent on annual fundraising of some $450,000 to $500,000 to close the gap between yearly expenditures
and the income drawn from tuition and the endowment. This left little margin for budgetary miscalculation and none at all for ambitious new programs, especially with the prospects of further expansion in the air. The committee also broached questions about alternatives to the fraternity system and the costs of constructing still more dormitories. After hearing a recommendation from a faculty committee on residential patterns, which concluded that no new fraternities should be added, Barnett warned the committee that they should be careful so that we don't raise the entire issue of the existence or non-existence of fraternities on campus. He was well aware of the controversy when Williams had abolished fraternities in 1962. But the subject of the numbers of fraternity and non-fraternity members at Colgate, especially how to increase the percentage of the latter, remained on the table, along with plans to erect two new dormitory complexes. In 1966 and 1967, two new residence facilities opened, named for Presidents Cutten and Bryan. With a total of 8 houses, each with its own dining room and social space, they housed 400 students and expanded the residential offerings for the growing number of students who decided not to join fraternities. Although a decision did not seem near at hand, coeducation was also under discussion in 1963. The planning committee members seemed favorably disposed, though tempering their deliberations here and there with a perhaps or a maybe. In meeting summaries, the consensus view was that the value of having bright women in the classroom with men perhaps would stimulate the men to better participation academically. They also advanced a social reason for coeducation, saying that 4 years of monastic existence in an isolated area is perhaps somewhat unnatural. But the committee demurred, feeling there was little empirical evidence to substantiate either the value of coeducation or the value of exclusively male education. Despite wanting more evidence for its educational benefits, all agreed that coeducation was a real possibility for the future. As deliberations continued into 1964, the committee returned to the subject of coeducation, discussing whether a coordinate college or full coeducation would be better for Colgate, and wondering whether an approach to Barnard College, rumored to be in financial difficulty, might be timely. Impetus to gather more information and make a decision about coeducation was growing. Coeducation aside, within a year of Barnett's arrival, plans for the future had taken concrete shape. Financially, the institution hoped to free itself from having to rely on the annual fund for meeting routine educational costs. It sought to add $15 million to the endowment by 1974. At least another $5 million would be raised for new construction. Academically, upgrading the faculty was the top priority, emphasizing the model of the teacher-scholar. The aim was to enhance the level of scholarly output consistent with the college's primary emphasis on teaching. And while the core would continue as the most distinctive feature of the educational program, a new academic calendar was introduced in 1964-65, 2 14-week semesters separated by a January period of independent study. The Jan plan would create many more opportunities for independent research and off-campus study. Admissions office policies underwent a subtler change. As a funding proposal put it, we do not expect to strive for a particular Colgate type, but to find room within an entering class for both the intellectual oddball and academic risk capital within reasonable limits. The Maroon editors put the challenge more bleakly, bemoaning the depressingly homogeneous and inert mass of the student population. They criticized the Colgate gentleman as too much inclined to seek the womb of executive orthodoxy to perceive or serve an increasingly demanding and dangerous world. A fellow student added his more colorful appraisal. Give us diversity. Give us some loners, somebody different, with ideas of his own for us to clash against, or even just give us a beard once in a while. The 1966 accreditation team from the Middle States Association of Colleges and Secondary Schools concluded that Colgate was a college vigorously and manifestly on the move. It is briskly in transition from a pat image of fervent loyalties centered on feats of athletic achievement to an alert and challenging community of sensitivity, intellectual search, and deep commitment to take part in a challenging and changing national, international, and global scene. Acknowledging that Colgate was well aware of its lack of diversity and the intellectual disadvantages of homogeneity, it urged more power in the direction of recruiting a student body which is more alert and committed intellectually, more diverse in cultural, economic, geographical, and ethnic background. For all its inspiring commitment to a liberal arts curriculum, its interdisciplinary work, and its expansive international curriculum, Colgate nevertheless left the accreditation committee with an unanswered question. What precisely does it mean to be and to become?